Good afternoon. It's my pleasure to have Neil Abernathy speaking today. Neil is an assistant professor in biomedical health informatics who's been here now a little over a year, who has appointments with us and in health services, broad interest in public health informatics, but his research interests are broad and include modeling infectious disease, global health, social network analysis, and this broad concept of integrating disparate streams of data, including genomic, clinical, surveillance, and geographic data. And he'll be speaking today on integrating diverse data sources for disease surveillance, and I'll give the bulk of the time to him because I know he has a lot of slides to get through and we want time for questions and answers. Thanks very much, Neil.
Great. So thanks, everyone, for coming. I do have a lot of slides to get through. I didn't have time to edit. I just bought a house, so I had time to put things in but not take them out. So quick overview of what I'll talk about today. I'm going to give examples of three different systems that are either in development or part of research going on here at the University of Washington that are informatics tools whose intent is to improve disease surveillance. So I'll briefly give an introduction to the problem, disease surveillance and control, the problem area, talk a little bit about surveillance and what it's trying to achieve. I'll discuss the three different tools. Outbreak Investigator was the software I developed as my dissertation and uses social network models to aid in contact investigation. EpiView is a tool developed at the Center for Public Health Informatics for GIS. And Distribute is a new project that Bill Lober and the CERG group are developing for to look at aggregate data for influenza. First few slides borrowed from Denise Koo of CDC, looking at the public health approach. So public health is a multifaceted discipline that has a broad reach. And the initial problem is to do surveillance and define what the problem, what the health problem is. And as we move from problem to defining the problem to response, we move up the scale to identifying risk factors. What is the cause of this problem that you've identified? Next would be an intervention. So if we posit an intervention, evaluating that intervention versus others to find out what works best. And then implementation is developing policy and figuring out how to actually put this intervention in place. So we're going to be focused mainly on the first block and maybe slightly on the second. So public health surveillance could be defined, and this is again from Denise, an ongoing systematic collection, analysis, and interpretation of health-related data essential to the planning, implementation, and evaluation of public health practice, closely integrated with the timely dissemination of these data to those responsible for prevention and control. So some keywords to notice there, systematic collection, analysis, and interpretation. That's where we often fall down. And then again, integrating that data with a timely dissemination of information for prevention, that's also a difficult spot. So the purposes of public health surveillance, to assess public health status. We want to know how healthy people are if there's a disease present, define public health priorities, to evaluate different programs, and stimulate research. So uses of public health surveillance are many. We want to estimate the magnitude of the problem. So where on this chart, you know, this is a plot of disease over time, how high is the level of disease in the population? Determine the geographic distribution of the illness. Where is it concentrated? Is there a region that has a higher burden than others? Portray the natural history of a disease. Detect epidemics or define a problem. So at this point in time, if there's an increase, sharp increase in the number of cases, we might decide that there is an outbreak or an epidemic. And several others, generate hypotheses, evaluate control measures, monitor changes in infectious agents, and detect changes in health practices, and facilitate planning. So one of the features that informatics tools often utilize to improve surveillance would be different algorithms that will help to analyze data that is coming in. So at the top I've shown aberration detection. So in the top row, and this is from Doug Friesma, we have events over time, and we might have a small epidemic curve. So that little bump would be the increase in cases over time. This might be a signal that we receive. So if this is the true state about that on the top, this might be the data that we're receiving from hospital data or from public health sampling or outreach. So the signal would more or less map, and those probably should be more aligned. But it might not be perfect, so it might be noisy data. And finally, we have a detector. So the aberration detection algorithm could say that when the number of cases rises over some baseline at that median, that we're going to declare that there's an aberration. We've detected that there's an event. There are other kinds of algorithms that are used, and you'll see some examples of those today. Visualization or layout algorithms, statistical or clustering algorithms, and a subset of algorithms that are specific to geospatial data. Among the broader goals that I mentioned, we also have a more pressing need for surveillance in that there are emerging threats. Some top concerns at present: H1N1, avian flu is still a concern, bioterrorism, and several emerging infections. And this is a news report from a couple years ago showing that the world faces increasing number of deadly diseases. There have been 40 new diseases discovered in the last 30 years. So there's this unprecedented number of diseases occurring for a variety of reasons, environmental and so forth. And millions are seen as possibly at risk for example, potential combination between H1N1 and H5N1. And also at the same time, there are re-emerging infections such as MDR-TB or XDR-TB that have been around for a long time, but in their new form, drug-resistant form, they are posing a threat to the population. So for all these reasons, we need to be able to have a clear picture of who is infected, how many people are infected, what is the level of morbidity and mortality for different diseases. This is from Taha Kass-Hout from INSTEAD, which is an offshoot of Google, showing an epidemic curve and what happens if we... I lost my little blip here, but if we don't detect that there's an epidemic until this stage in this epidemic curve, there's a lag time from detection to response. So the opportunity for control of the disease, we might lose that opportunity. If this is the natural epidemic curve, we're coming in too late in the cycle to help those the bulk of the population that's affected. However, if we can have an earlier detection, we still have an opportunity earlier in the course of the epidemic curve to potentially prevent the disease. H1N1 is a perfect example. We had a small outbreak in April, and that gave the world time enough to start making vaccines, which are now a little slow to come out. But that was arguably an earlier detection afforded by a fortunate advanced laboratory detection in San Diego that enabled refinement of that H1N1 specimen to realize that it was a new strain. So as we look at public health measures that we want to take, we can look at how people go from being exposed to actually entering into the public health system and our ability to surveil or utilize that information. So first they're exposed and they're infected. After that, they experience symptoms, subset at each stage. So not everyone that's exposed is infected and so on. Of those who have symptoms, only some see medical attention. If we wait till the very top of the pyramid until some smaller fraction of those individuals is reported by the healthcare system, then we've lost a lot of time, and as time goes on here, we're potentially losing the opportunity to catch that epidemic earlier. And if we can catch something lower down in the pyramid, we might have greater sensitivity, although potentially higher error rate, and greater timeliness if pyramid, we would have higher specificity. So this is putting the pyramid on its side and just visualizing it, that this is the time, the way it's usually plotted for showing the epidemic curve. We want to get earlier in that, along that time. So what are the roles of informatics in this process? The several functions that were listed for surveillance, for collection, there's knowledge representation, building databases, developing standards such that data can be compiled and shared across jurisdictions, data integration, not just of different data sources from different jurisdictions, but also different data types. So for example, if you have genotype data, if you have clinical data, if you have aggregated public health surveillance data, those are different data types that need to be integrated. For analysis, aberration detection algorithms. For interpretation, visualization. And GIS could fit in either one of those, either an analysis or interpretation. So at this point, I'll give you some examples of three different tools that have been developed somewhat independently by researchers here at the University of Washington, although certainly there's been a sharing of ideas and expertise. So the bulk of the talk from here on out will be about my dissertation work, because that's what I know most about. And so I developed a tool called the Outbreak Investigator. And the motivation for this was tuberculosis control. Tuberculosis is a communicable disease, typically affecting the lungs. People cough, and if you're exposed to someone who's coughing and has TB disease, you can get infected. And about 10% of people that are infected go on to have disease. But a remarkable 2 billion people across the world are infected of TB latently. It's largely under control in the U.S., but it's persistent in homeless populations, foreign-born individuals, and HIV-positive individuals, and in prisons. So these are hard-to-reach populations, and the cases are complex. They're difficult to diagnose, treat, and manage. It can take months of treatment, and this is even if they're susceptible to the drug treatments. If they're resistant to drugs, it can take up to 2 years for treatment. And there's not always a good cure rate. There's diverse data resulting from this complex clinical picture. There's population data, social data, in that when someone gets infected, the public health agency will interview that individual, what's called contact investigation, to identify people who may have been exposed. There's location-based surveillance if there's a particular hot spot, such as a downtown area that might have a high proportion of tuberculosis, and other risk factors. Two different types of data that are involved that I noticed weren't really being brought together were contact investigation data and genotyping data. So contact investigation, the goal is to not just to identify people who have been exposed to a contact, but also new active cases. Around 1% of contacts have active TB, so that's a 100-fold increase over the general population. So this is a highly cost-effective procedure. At the same time, there are some problems that we'll get into shortly. Genotyping is a newer method wherein we can look at the genetic fingerprint of the tuberculosis strain of the particular case, and identify similar strains that might be cropping up in the population. So if you have 10 cases in 2 months in Seattle, are those 10 cases the same strain or are they not? So the answer will, depending on that answer, you may or may not have an epidemic. It could just be coincidence because there's a long latency with TB that, you know, maybe some foreign-born elderly person has had it for 50 years, has been infected, but they've only now gotten sick. Or are there 10 cases all of the same strain that would more likely indicate there was an outbreak? The availability of the genotyping data changes the way contact investigation is done, because now you're not just starting with a single person who's infected and trying to branch out from that individual. You're actually looking at two cases of the same strain and trying to figure out maybe how they're connected. You know, do they have the same hangouts? Do they associate with the same people? So these are two techniques that feed into each other. However, there's some problems with these methods. With contact investigation, cases aren't always knowledgeable or straightforward about their contacts. If there was an illicit mode of transmission, perhaps alcohol use is a risk factor, drug use is a risk factor for TB. So someone might not want to tell you about the place that they are hanging out and that they may have been exposed. A homeless individual might not know the full name of their friend on the street. They might just know a street name or know the person by face only. The clusters can be geographically distributed, so there have been many examples of outbreaks that are across, say, the Pacific Northwest, and there are different jurisdictions that are handling those. So even within a city, an investigation can be distributed among interviewers. So if you have a Chinese-speaking case and an English-speaking case, those individuals might get two different caseworkers or two different disease investigators trying to elicit information from them. So then you have two people in the public health system that have different pieces of knowledge about what is essentially the same outbreak. As far as the genotypes, they have widely varying prevalence. So one genotype can be extremely rare. Another one is extremely common. And so just the fact that you have 10 of this genotype or 10 of that genotype, that doesn't mean the same thing. 10 of the rare genotype would be a huge alarm. 10 of the common genotype, maybe not so big of a deal. Furthermore, there's a disconnect between the health workers and the lab results. So there's difficulty in interpreting this data. The genotyping can take a long time, so often the investigations proceed without the benefit of that data. And there's a lack of tools to investigators to deal with it. So here's an example of a social network that was used. And social network analysis is a new technique that's being promoted in TB contact investigation to help integrate some of this data. So here a tie between nodes, and these circles or squares are individuals with TB. A line between those two would indicate that there's some contact between those cases. They're also using the graph to demonstrate that there is a DNA match, so a genetic match between strains in these cases. This visualization is being used to convey that information, and as well as time, we can see on the left the growth of that epidemic from 96 to 99. Here the network becomes a means to join this different kind of information together. Different ways that these visualizations are used in public health and in disease investigation are still being researched. So people find an intrinsic value in it, but few studies have studied that to show a final benefit to public health. A problem statement. Networks show promise to elucidate patterns of disease transmission, the network modeling software required expert knowledge. The networks that are created are often static, so they don't reflect real-time data. There's also this genetic, geographic, and clinical risk factors, which are not always incorporated into those. So we need a mediating technology to simplify the generation and visualization of that data. Whereas social networks seem likely to improve contact investigation, then models still need evaluation, the tools require expertise, and the data are very unstandardized, I hypothesize that a core set of data could be identified and that automating these network models would improve the utilization of the data. So here's kind of a picture for you, and this is just in San Francisco where I did my work. If one person is get sick with TB, they collect a sample, that sample is sent for drug susceptibilities to one lab, it's sent for genotyping, the same sample to another lab once it's grown up at this lab. Clinical data on that patient resides at the hospital. Contact investigation and diagnostics and treatment data are held here at the TB clinic. To further complicate that, there was a second lab doing additional genotyping at Stanford University. Early on in my work, I took a look at the databases that these people were using for the same patients, same sources of data. They're all partners in a big grant. And every single one of them was using a different database, different variable names, different database schema. And at the end of the day, needing to bring all that data back together just to analyze or do research, follow up on those individual patients. So even when everyone's working together as a team in a very small jurisdiction, relatively, we can have these problems of proliferation of different data types and different data representations. So recognizing that this could be a problem if I try to apply these techniques nationwide, I undertook a study to look at the data forms that were used for conduct investigation to see to what extent is there some standard core set of data that we rely on with which we would conduct some amount of analysis. So this is an example of one of the simpler forms that is used. So if someone gets sick, you would ask the name of their contacts, and we list several of them here, the date of birth, the test for TB, the date that it was placed, and several other attributes for the health worker to evaluate those different contacts. So this form has 7 or 8 fields. Some of them had upwards of 30 for each individual line listing of a contact. I collected these forms from at least one example from each of the 50 states and a few other jurisdictions. And a lot of people have seen this slide because I use it quite a lot to show the diversity of the fields. But if we code a 0 and 1 for the presence or absence of a field, we have the states on the left that are clustered hierarchically and the fields that are clustered hierarchically on the other axis. And the use of this is to show that, first of all, there's a large group of fields that seem to be common across many of the states. And so although there is a lot of noise, the clustering technique helps helps us to hide some of that noise. We can also see, in addition to these core fields, we have some other modules of data, such as patient history, treatment, and identity, and exposure as well. And the good news is, out of the 14 core fields, seven of them are relevant to social network analysis. So either identifying the node uniquely so that we can say that this individual is who we believe they are, or identifying the relationship between the case and the contact. So that's good news. And generally, just going back to that, any surveillance system, whether it's run by the CDC or me doing my PhD thesis, it's going to run into this problem where there are many different representations of data, and therefore establishing standards and having data sharing agreements, these are challenging issues in doing aggregating that data for nationwide surveillance. So here's another example of a network that shows integrates the genotyping data and some information about location. So again, the lines or links between nodes show a social contact. In this example, we also have, so the triangles and circles are cases and contacts, respectively. The squares in this graph actually represent shelters or hotels where individuals are staying. So in San Francisco, as in many other places in the U.S., the homeless population, there's higher rates of TB. So often there will be association with a particular shelter that people stay in the same place, they infect each other. The red triangles and green triangles are two different strains of TB. So these were originally thought to be the same, part of the same epidemic by the health department, and they were investigating it as this growing problem. And it turned out using the network analysis and the advanced genotyping in concert, we were able to show that there seemed to be a concentration of the red, that's the second red genotype, in this core group that's also affiliated closely with many of the shelters. It's not conclusive, but it gave a hint that there seemed to be a higher prevalence of that strain in that setting. So again, we're using this visualization to help us cognitively integrate different kinds of data. And the challenge is to generate these semi-automatically. This one was generated by me by hand. So in the subsequent slides, we'll show a tool that will attempt to do that. So I'll skip this because we're running a little shy on time. The design of the Outbreak Investigator is a three-tier architecture where there's a client at a web client user, so multiple users can access the CGI, which is Perl CGI that taps into the database server to refer user queries, takes that, the resulting data, sends it to a layout algorithm so that we can, the data that we've collected from here can be turned into this nice network graph. And so some of the example queries, and these are English language queries, so that the user doesn't have to have technical expertise, and this is an advance over other network software, would be things such as show contacts of a case, optionally showing risk factors such as place of birth or HIV status, show contact between cluster cases. So if you have two cases of the same strain of TB and you don't know how they're connected, I want you, the system, to show me that in the network. Show all contacts of cluster cases. And I'll show you a few examples of these in subsequent slides. So here we're going to take a patient with this ID, or alternately we can type in their name and the system will search by name, and show contacts of the case and show immigration status. So whether they're green or brown, green shows the case of TB, brown is the contact who did not become a case. And whether they're opaque or transparent, the transparent nodes are highlighted to show their immigration status. So these would be foreign-born cases. So we know, starting with this person as a query, that here's another case of TB that's a foreign-born, another foreign-born case who has contact with that individual. This is a foreign-born individual who was a contact but did not have TB. By clicking on the nodes, we can get additional patient detail. And that will also allow us to iteratively query, because that whatever you click on will be entered into the query box. So in this example, we're looking for all connections between any case of the same strain of TB. So the strain ID that I've given is a particular genotype, so we know that there's some chain of transmission likely between most of these cases. I want to display all the contacts that have been identified. So we can see that star in the upper segment. Those are the ones that we've most identified. That doesn't mean that that's the source of the disease or that that's where the transmission is happening, but it is a place to start, and it is representative of the information that's been collected. And these are fake names, which is why they don't make sense, but the names would display of all the cases that are displayed on the left. Clicking on a name highlights a node. On a node highlights the name, and that again allows the iterative queries. So you can drill down on a particular case of interest. In this example, we're showing cases that are connected to each other only through a shared contact. So, say Mark has TB and I have TB, but we don't know each other, but we both know Peter. And so this query is going to show here's two cases and here's the shared contact. So this example might help prioritize the contact investigation because these two individuals, although we don't have evidence that they're directly connected, they do know two people in common. So we would be more likely to think that they would have met or spread TB, or might have some third case that's a contact that infected another one. In this example, we're using another technique to display the cases according to the size of the number of cases over a particular region in San Francisco. So getting toward GIS, it's not the formal GIS system. However, so the size of the bubble indicates that there are more cases in that region than this other region. Clicking on those bubbles again calls up the number or the cases that are infected in that particular region. So these are visualizations that help for surveillance and help for awareness of the state of the disease as it's been determined by public health, but it's not just static, it's interactive. So it helps the health worker answer the queries that answer and get the information that they need out of it. And so I put this arrow there to indicate this ability to cyclically, iteratively, ask queries, because you can start with a geographic query, find that there's a case of interest, and then perform a social network query based on that individual. So it helps link the social and the geographic and the genetic through this interactive visualization. In this example, we're showing an epidemic curve, and again, it's showing the number of cases over time, and they're interactive and clickable, so if you want to know how many cases there were in 1992 and who they were, and to explore that network, then you can do that. With many infectious diseases, they're not as slow as TB. So you can see TB is very has a long latency period, so we can look over years and see the epidemic curve. But other infectious diseases might be a period of weeks. And as a matter of fact, I didn't have time to include examples from some recent work with Seattle King County, but we actually have put into place in their communicable disease unit the queries that will help draw the data that could be imported into this tool. So and when the April swine flu outbreak occurred, we put those in place so that that information could be, the contacts could be identified. And we found several data fields and places where they were failing to identify contacts in their own data. So summary of outbreak investigator enables disease investigators to utilize network models, introduces an interactive user-driven interface, provides a reusable platform. So none of the code is specific to TB. It's designed in a way that you could plug in any other network-based data. And it generalizes to other diseases and domains. And it aids also in several steps in disease surveillance and control that we mentioned at the beginning of the talk, to estimate the magnitude of a problem, to determine the geographic distribution of the illness, to detect epidemics or define a problem, to generate hypotheses. For example, if you don't understand why two individuals are connected, or if you're looking for it, perhaps your hypothesis is that they are geographically clustered. This can help you evaluate those hypotheses and monitor changes in infectious agents. So next I'll talk very briefly about EpiView, which is a project developed at CEPHI to, similar in spirit, to integrate available public health data, GIS visualization tools, and statistical analysis algorithms. So it's an open source application framework composed exclusively of publicly available technologies for geospatial visualization of public health data. So this is perhaps a too complex graph, but up above it's showing a three-tier architecture from the client, the server, to the database server. And down below it's showing the availability of these tools such as Google Maps, J3 chart library, and the R statistical and graphics package. They've also attached it to SatScan. The tools on the upper half can access, or the different points of this architecture can access these. The point of having multiple arrows is that the client at some point actually can access Google Maps and, for dynamic visualization. So here's an example, and I'll give you a real life screenshot example in a moment. The FPView client browser will display certain data using the secure server, which is connecting to public health data and also to Google Maps. So in this example, they've plotted data using Google Maps, but it's also clickable. So by connecting this to J3 chart, they can then give the user further information about that particular region. In this example, it's a similar idea, but instead of visualizing additional information, it's actually performing a statistical test and accessing the statistical package to show the likelihood of a particular geospatial association at that region of the disease. The platform is very flexible, so that you're able to easily connect to new data sources. So when the H1N1 influenza outbreak happened in April, in a matter of days, actually I think probably one day, they were able to connect that data source table directly to EpiView for visualization. A further project came along the next week of needing to get out data to the pharmacies, and again, very quickly, the tool was able to load up and display that information. And, you know, this is something Google Maps could do by itself, so just being able to display something on a map is not innovative. The innovative part is that the architecture allows connection to additional algorithms and processing of that information so that you're not just displaying it, you're also linking together the statistics and the visualization. Yet another example with King County Public Health restaurant inspections, linking a publicly available data source and then displaying that data from a different set of locations. So one table would have restaurant names and health grades, and another table would have restaurants and locations, and EpiView helps to integrate that information. So a third tool that's recently under development through the Clinical Informatics Research Group with Phil Lober is Distribute. And so Distribute has both the public and private site. It's a tool to monitor influenza-like illness syndrome to do surveillance based on aggregate level data. So one problem that has been faced in the disease surveillance community has been getting all the hospitals to play nice and share real patient level data real time. Organizations don't like to do this. They're afraid there may be errors in their data. They don't want to be held accountable for something before they've gone through their own procedures to check it. There are huge privacy concerns about sharing patient level information. And so CDC and Department of Defense, Department of Homeland Security efforts to get that patient level data in real time has met with some challenges. And so remember back in the earlier part of the talk, we were discussing that we want to get earlier and earlier in that timeline. So for syndromic surveillance, people have looked at multiple sources, such as even web searches or pharmacy purchases, to try to identify potential cases of a disease before people show up to the hospital. Once they get to the hospital, you can look at emergency department admissions before a definitive diagnosis has been achieved. So this is the kind of data that the organizations tend to be a little worried about releasing in a patient level. So the innovation, or the good thing about Distribute, is that it uses aggregate level data. So they are just saying, tell us how many cases have showed up of influenza-like illness to your organization today between the ages of 5 and 18, male, female, and that's all we want to know. We don't want to know any other identifying patient data. Another trade-off with Distribute, in addition to having patient-level data, is that it uses a broad definition of influenza. So each organization has its own rules that are used to determine whether something is influenza-like illness or not. However, on the good side, it's data that is submitted electronically. So the rules that are in place at each organization are likely to be adhered to routinely. So you're not getting different interpretations on each day per organization. And this is the website. You can check it out if you like. So here's an example from the public site where they're kind of smoothing over the data of the emergency department visits per each state. And they're showing whether the number of cases has gone up or down. So here, Distribute is integrating these different data streams, not different data types. It also produces a map showing you per region if the number of cases is increasing or decreasing. And I'll just note that in the last few months, the number of participants in Distribute has probably doubled, at least, maybe trebled. So this is Bill was developing this before H1N1 hit, and it was just very timely that it was available when that disease gained prevalence. So here's a more detailed view from the daily data.
So for Washington State, again, this is from the public site, you can see the number of cases that is going up down by day. This is what's called the first plot, so it's showing you a blurred representation by age. So these are age groupings of low to high to show where the mass of those cases are per age group. So in this spike, you can see that from 0 to 17 in 1944, and the 65 plus population that they have. But as it continued along, the 65 plus were the ones that had more cases over time.
And that could be different at different locations and different points in the curve. So that's just another visualization option. So Distribute, like the other two tools, accesses visualization algorithms, types that data into the algorithms that it's receiving more or less live. We can't actually call it live because the data that Distribute receives is an upload. And I don't know from Bill, but I'm guessing it's about daily. If anyone knows better, please let me know. But I think it's a daily upload of the data. So the private site has for Distribute has a little more information, counts, proportions, and totals, and it also has more interactive visualizations. So any of these additional queries can be asked. So graphing a syndrome stratified by temperature, by disposition, by age group, comparing the severity of the disease stratified by age group, just for example. And here's an example of one of those more detailed graphs that are available only to the participants in Distribute. The jurisdiction has been blanked out because they're still a little touchy even about giving this aggregate data early on in the relationship. And we can see that blue, red, yellow are the discharge transferred. And we can see the levels of each case for this specific jurisdiction. So it gives a really unprecedented view into this hospital data. It's aggregated, but still very, very useful. And by having that trade-off of using aggregate data, he's able to sign up more users quickly. So this is an incomplete and probably noisy comparison of the tools. Not meant for you to digest all of this, but just to show that all three of them have several attributes of, for example, combining multiple data sources, calling display algorithms, delivering services over the web, supporting user queries, whether or not they use real-time data. You'll see that there are a few gray spots out in Distribute, and I just highlight that it's still very new, and that's so Distribute is not inferior. It's just under active development, whereas these two could use an infusion of research money to continue their development. But I think the themes emerge that we're not just producing a static graph, we're not just giving a monthly report. These are interactive, real-time data that hopefully are integrating multiple types of data to give a better window into how disease is spreading in the population. So there are many other surveillance tools, several of them that are in production and widely used. BioSense is a CDC tool, Essence is Department of Defense, which detects multiple syndromes. RODS is probably the chief research university-based system. HealthMap maps global outbreak reports from various sources onto a Google map. Google Flu Trends, you may have heard of, uses internet searches of terms that Google has decided are indicative of people searching for flu information about flu symptoms. So of several candidate terms, they identified the ones that seem to map to actual data. So you looking at actual flu trends from the past, these terms seem most predictive of those. And so Google Flu Trends may offer 1 or 2 weeks of more advanced notice of that there's some kind of circulating symptom in the population.
So it's very, very early in that pyramid. So before people have even gone to the pharmacy, they're just looking up to see what they have. At the same time, the sensitivity is high, but the specificity is likely low. And instead, Evolve is a new effort. Instead, is a Google offshoot that uses population-based surveillance with cell phones. So they want to do a similar thing that for Google Flu Trends, but recognizing that the world is getting connected through the internet, through cell phones faster than computers, they want to enable people to interact with the system and report their own symptoms, even in very remote locations in developing countries. So these are just a sample, and several of them, especially RODS, uses a multitude of different aberration detection algorithms, and I didn't have time to get into depth with that, but a lot of the really cool mathematics and informatics methods for noticing that spike, knowing that something is out of the ordinary, are employed in that tool. And I think the three tools we did talk about today have done one of the harder things, which is getting the data together. Anybody can plug an algorithm or apply an algorithm to data that you have. Getting the data together is the real difficult challenge. For some of the mentioned reasons I mentioned earlier. So, conclusion, public health data are diverse, they're unstandardized, they're underutilized. There's increasing complexity in the data, which requires new ways to synthesize it. Barriers exist to interpreting and interacting with information. Integration of multiple data sources and types is key to public health surveillance. Informatics plays a role in several surveillance functions and collection, analysis, and interpretation of data. And interactive tools keep users in the loop, which is very critical for proper interpretation, because there can be errant spikes, there can be outbreaks that are within subpopulations that a algorithm alone is not going to recognize. And ultimately, human beings need to decide what is the appropriate response. So several acknowledgments. Many people helped me with Outbreak Investigator. Distribute is Bill Ober and the CERG team. FEU is Jim Wallace and me and the CEPI team. And of course, Denise Koo and some of the other slides that I borrowed. So thank you. If any questions? Jamie, go
for
it.
As I mentioned, the way contact investigation is performed changed after genotyping came around. It's not changed very much. It's starting to change. It's changing more. But the interplay between the genotyping and the contact investigation is still evolving. The health workers that are doing those investigations tend to be more have more expertise in interviewing and understanding that individual case of TB, finding out where they might have got infected, who they might have infected, who they spent time with. They try to get as much data as they can, name, place of birth, or date of birth, gender, address, phone number, anything that you can provide about your contacts. Typically, more than 12 hours of contact are needed to constitute exposure to TB, and depending on how infectious the person is, that could be even higher. So it's unlikely that you're going to have zero information about the individual. However, they do sometimes get partial names or John Smith or something that they have trouble nailing down to a single individual. And that, unfortunately, can impact how the investigation proceeds. So you might be more likely to call and follow up the contact whose information you have and where the number actually rings and the person actually answers and they decide they are willing to come in. So there's a whole string of things that happen after you get the name. And sometimes for expedience, the easiest contact is followed. When there is genotype data available, the first thing that happens is usually that a risk factor is identified, such as homelessness. So there are twice as many homeless people within the 10 cases that we have as there are in the general TB population. So we know that that tends to be a risk factor for for people, we think that that might be the source of exposure. When we get a new case in, even though it might be 3 weeks before we get the genotyping data back, we're going to ask additional questions. Did you go to the, have you spent time in this homeless shelter? You know, did you go to this bar? Things like that. So it can impact the way the questions are answered or asked, as long as there's institutional understanding that that outbreak is happening. That's where the genotyping still has a long way to go in its use. That technology itself has evolved and changed so frequently and so rapidly that there are still some old attitudes about, oh, the genotyping 10 years ago was really slow, so we don't trust it, we're just going to do our investigation, even though the genotyping now is faster and it's more standardized and it's more reliable. So there's still some catch-up happening. In the meantime, the genotyping methods will change again before that's done. But sometimes now there are outbreak-driven investigations, or outbreak-driven even screenings. Sometimes the contact investigation is bypassed entirely. If you find you have, you know, five people of the same genotype in this hotel, dump the contact investigation and just go screen everybody in the hotel. And so that's now starting to happen. Did that start to answer your question?
So with respect to the syndromic surveillance, when people are selecting the predictive variables, how is that done? Do people cast a wide net to try and find those, or is it still sort of a best guess?
There have been studies of the sensitivity and specificity of individual symptoms or rules for calling something influenza-like illness, for example, that being the most studied case. Using some gold standard from some data set, they can look at several definitions of what if we called influenza-like illness fever plus this, or cough plus that, and so look at all those different definitions and figure out which provides the best sensitivity and specificity. And you might want different things for different diseases. So maybe anthrax, you want something that's really sensitive, and ILL, maybe you want specific. So there are going to be different, potentially different motivations depending on the disease. That needs more study.
Well, specifically sort of backing out even further with respect to sort of more distant things like visits to the pharmacy, purchases of particular medicines, Google searches, things where it's
sure
relatively removable, like a medical diagnosis.
That there are kind of fads in disease surveillance, and I'm not the sole expert. In fact, the Disease Surveillance Society is meeting right now in Florida, and I'm not there. Trying to monitor the number of times the toilet flushes a day, that fad is kind of fading a little bit, and that it's seen as too downstream, if you will, from what you're actually trying to measure. But there are certainly attempts to try to quantify for each thing that you're detecting the degree to which it's predictive of the quantity you're trying to measure. The problem is that there could be different usage patterns, like pharmacy usage patterns or medical care usage patterns in different regions and different populations. So then suddenly you've done this study, this great, fantastic study in Pittsburgh, and nobody else can use it. So I think this will be, if you want a career with many publications, and like a lifelong list of publications, if you could become an expert in that, you will, I think, continue to be employed. Well, it is just that jurisdictions and organizations, hospitals themselves, are reluctant to share real-time, patient-level, non-anonymized data. So they have to sign up voluntarily. They can't be compelled easily to just submit that data. Therefore, this is seen as a way to get an earlier signal anonymously. We'll get the real actual data later by disease reporting laws, but this is something that can be useful in that week or two before the canonical data is then forwarded.
So what is the method to measure the count? I mean, it's based on
I'm sorry.
Why is the method to measure the count?
It varies by each jurisdiction. So, as I mentioned, the fever plus cough, that could be the definition in one place, and there could be a different definition in some other place. So that's one of the downsides of this approach. Thanks very much.